This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have done things and endured things that most of us would have a hard time imagining. That's the case today as we pick up where we left off last time with 92-year-old Ray Maloney of Bonita Springs, Florida. If you missed the first half of the interview, you can find that podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. Shot down on his 37th mission as a P-47 Thunderbolt pilot with the 86th Fighter Bomber Group, the 527th Squadron, Ray was hurt badly and captured by German forces. In fact, the first prison camp he ended up in was Stalag Luft 3 in Zagan, which is now within Polish borders, and that's the camp where a couple famous prisoner escapes occurred, inspiring the classic movie, The Great Escape. Something tells me you heard about those escapes.
In fact, I talked to some of the fellows who had escaped and were recaptured and weren't part of the 50 that were executed. 76 got out, and 3 made it to Sweden. So, but the Germans recaptured 73 of them and executed 50 of them. Mm-hmm. And so the other 20-some were put back in the camp, and I got to talk to a couple of them off and on. They were all mostly RAF guys, you know.
Well, and you would end up spending a lot of time with the RAF guys.
Yeah, I was in the compound with them, yeah. I was the only American in my room. They were all Englishmen.
What was life like in that POW camp on a day-to-day basis? What kinds of things did you do to pass the time, and what kind of kept you going?
Well, first of all, you know, as I mentioned when we started talking, Paul, being a prisoner of war is a degrading, humiliating kind of experience, and it's not something that I'm proud of. It didn't take any skill or, you know, specialty to get captured. And because I didn't finish my tour, and a lot of my friends did, and a lot of my friends were killed, I always felt guilty about being, and I could tell from talking to other people in the camp, they have the same feeling, that it's a terrible guilt feeling that you're not helping at this point, you know. Even though your instructions are, when you are captured, you are still a military, you're still U.S. Army, and your responsibility is to do what you can to, you know, confuse, confound, and, you know, aggravate the enemy as much as you can.
That's probably my favorite line from that movie, The Great Escape. It's put so well by, I think, one of the British officers, the character in that film, where he says it's the sworn duty of every serviceman to escape, do everything he can to escape. So did you do any of those things?
Well, I was, you know, a junior. Here I am, a second lieutenant. Yeah. I'd just been shot down, and I was in a room with fellows that had been down since Tobruk, you know, 4 years before that, you know. So they had all the experience in the world. And I was a know-nothing, you know, an American. But you knew that they had learned over the months and years how to survive mentally and emotionally, you know, in a prison camp. And it helped me get through, you know. As you say, you've got this guilt feeling, and they would talk about it too, that, you know, we're here and we're not doing anything. But at the same time, I had heard stories about the Germans, at least the ones that ran the camps, were kind of single-minded, you know. And the British are delightful at deceiving, and, you know, what looks like something is not really it. You know, the British are great at this.
Uh-huh.
And they would, the story I used to get was that they would occasionally leave a plan for tunnels that didn't exist, you see. And they'd leave them somewhere where the German ferrets, we used to have guards come through with overalls on and screwdrivers and flashlights, and they were forever climbing under the barracks or in the attic, you know, something, trying to find what we're doing, you know, escape activities. They would just go in great glee when the Germans had found some plan for underground tunnels, you see. And then the Germans would bring in trucks to ride around the outside to try to collapse any of the tunnels and drive big iron bars down into the ground, you know, to feel if they're going to hit the top of the tunnel. And the Brits would just sit there, you know, and giggle and watch all this, you know.
That's classic.
It was nothing, yeah. They knew how to survive, you know. They had a little library. The Swiss Red Cross, the International Red Cross, of course, used to, I'll talk about the food in a minute, but the Red Cross got in a few books and a couple of guitars and a bugle or something, and so the guys that could play. And, you know, this compound that we were in had 1,400 British guys and 212 Americans. But even in that small of cadre, no matter what you wanted to do, you could find somebody that knew how to do that, you know, whether it was play an instrument or run a railroad or dig tunnels or run trains or, you know, photograph. And you remember in the movie, and a lot of that was true, they were actually getting photographs and reproducing railroad passes and identification papers with photographs on them. And we even, I shouldn't say we, the British had it, they had a two-way radio in the camp.
That they avoided having captured, which must have been pretty tricky to have it confiscated.
Well, we were counted twice a day, once in the morning and once just before dinner. And the radio would go out into the compound in the pockets of about 50 or 60 people. Each one had little parts of it. Yeah. And when the only time the radio came together, it was when in the evenings the British BBC would broadcast the news at dictation speed. And this was given to some underground transmission station in Poland. And Sagan was right on the Polish border. In fact, now Sagan is in Poland.
Right, but, where Stalag Luft 3 was.
Yeah, where Luft 3 was. And the Polish underground would retransmit this. And somebody, and I never knew, you know, the fewer guys that knew about these things, the better off. Somebody would put the radio together, listen to the news, copy it down on a little piece of paper, and somebody would go around to each barracks and room by room, and he'd come in at nighttime and he'd hand you this piece of paper. You weren't allowed to talk about it or anything. You read it and give it back to him, and then he gives it to the next guy. So each guy in a room reads it, and then he takes it to the next room. And so that's how you know what's going on, you know.
And you had to do it that way to avoid losing this great privilege of getting some outside information.
That's right. That's right. And the other, as I say, it was a two-way radio. When a new prisoner, Kriegsgefangenen was the name for war prison in Germany. When a new Kriegi came into the camp, one of the first things they would do was a committee would interrogate him. First of all, they wanted to decide whether he was a true ally, you know, whether he was what he said he was, you know, instead of some a German plant.
So the prisoners would interrogate the new prisoners.
New prisons, right. Yeah. First of all, was to find out if you were valid, you know, if you were, say, you were what you were. And that was the first thing. The second thing was, how did you get captured and what part of Germany and how did you get gone? Tell me all about it. And we came up the Brenner Pass, you know, from Italy to get into Germany. And they wanted to know all about the Brenner Pass and all of the, you know, what I saw, anti-aircraft placements and stuff going up. And all of that would be transmitted out to the Polish underground, back to England. And so they were putting all this stuff together. It was
so you were saying earlier how so many of you felt useless or guilty that you weren't helping. But, I mean, these guys are passing on some pretty important strategic information.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Some of it was, you know, quite valuable. For evading, for instance, I had heard stories about always look like you belong where you were, you know, like you were part of the community. And so there was one story about a fellow who stole a cow and walked it across half of France. In fact, walked the cow to death. The cow died.
There goes his cover.
Yeah, the cow died, I heard. And the other one was a guy stole a wheelbarrow and pushed the wheel down halfway across Germany and France, you know, to get out of these places.
And did you ever seriously contemplate escape, not knowing how long you're going
to
be there?
Yes, I did to the extent that in talking to some fellows in my very room, they wanted to know, about 2 miles up the road from Sagan was a fighter base, an advanced training for 109s, ME-109s. And the 109 guys knew that this was an air camp. All the airmen were in this camp. And they used to buzz us all the time, right across the top of the thing. And then we all look up and say, spin in, you. But anyway, to answer your question about my escape, it never came about. But when they asked me, they said they were cooking up something to see if they could get a few guys down to the airbase and steal some airplanes and crank them up and go. And they were ME-109, so they wanted fighter pilots.
Right.
And it so happens that I was the only fighter pilot in my room. They were all bomber.
Yeah,
Lancaster.
These would all be bomber crews.
Yeah,
mostly.
These were all bomber crews, navigators. And
that kind of underscores something. I don't want to get off on a tangent. Mm. But you said earlier you had only considered finishing your missions or being killed. Really, for fighters, that was the more likely scenario. There weren't a whole lot of fighter pilots who became prisoners of war. I mean, there were some.
Yeah.
But you were most. I mean,
yeah,
you were
right.
Much more likely to be a POW on a bomber crew than a fighter pilot.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
So you beat some odds there, just surviving.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
When I said I'd consider escaping. And so a few days later, a guy came to me, came into the room, British RAF guy, and he had a little pack. He said, "You're Lieutenant Maloney?" And I said, "Yes, yes." And identified myself, and so he knew I was the guy. And he said, "All right." He opened up this little pack, and he handed me about 4 or 5 photographs of the cockpit of a ME-109.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, big, 8.5 by 11. And he said, "Study these, and I'll be back in about an hour and so and take them." He said, "I won't leave them overnight with you." I said, "Okay." So I studied them for a while, and he came by, and we did this for about 2 or 3 times. Meanwhile, there was some activity going on somewhere that they don't tell you about, about how you're going to get out of here. But I did my part, and I do remember another thing that occurred in my room was we got in a checker game with a checkerboard, and the fellows in the room took a sponge with some water and wiped warm water it across the back side of the checkerboard, right? And when it was kind of soaked, and I thought they were going to ruin this thing, they peeled off the back layer, and here was a silk map of Germany, and a really fine map. It was the ones that, like, they had in your escape kit.
Uh-huh.
We used to carry a little escape kit with a medical syringe and a few things and a compass, chocolate bar, and a map and some German money and stuff,
uh-huh.
Like that, a little tiny pack. And so they were going to use this, and that disappeared. But I saw this silk map come out the back of the thing. And they had buttons that were compasses.
You mean shirt buttons?
Shirt buttons, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And a little metal button, and it kind of had a flat edge. And then a little thing on top, and a little dab of, I guess, some magnetic something on the thing. And what you had to do was put a needle or a pin on top of it and let it just sit there. And the little thing would turn, and you had a compass.
Ingenious.
Yeah, it was. It was incredible. But this was all part. Oh, and another part of the escape activities, we always kept track of what Germans were in the camp. And the nearest barracks to the gates where they came and went through the gun, in one of the rooms where you were within sight of that, and I caught this duty a few times, you'd sit there, and everybody that came in, you had a book, and you'd write down what time. And if you didn't know who it was, you described him, German with a hat and this or that, or what his rank was or something. And he went to barracks number so-and-so at such a time. And so they kept track of where every German was in that compound all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We knew. So if the Germans ever gotten close to where they were digging a tunnel or doing something, immediately everything would be shut down and they'd come out of the tunnel and, cover up everything within a matter of just a few seconds if some German headed to the wrong barracks. And this was done all the time. And I can remember sitting there by the hour watching these guys come through and try to describe who it was writing in the book. You never felt that you were out of the military. You were still in the military, and we had a senior RAF group captain who was the senior man in our compound, and we did what he said. Now, the food.
I've heard some stories now.
Yeah, right. The movies never describe, never get into this. But there is an absolute eternal hunger, a yearning for food. You don't get enough food, and you're hungry. It's gnawing at you.
Well, most of us have no idea what that feels like. It's break time, but when we come back, we're going to find out what kept Ray alive in captivity, and what did it feel like to become a free man again after six excruciating months. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening to the captivating story of 92-year-old Ray Maloney, a P-47 pilot shot down a week before his 22nd birthday in 1944, and a prisoner of war for 6 months after that. When we left off, he was describing the incomparable hunger he experienced as a POW. Now let's find out how he managed to survive.
The only thing that would kept us alive was Red Cross parcels used to come through. Not all the time, but when they came through, the package was about 11 pounds of food, and it had like a can of corned beef and some biscuits and a chocolate bar, a couple of packs of cigarettes, powdered milk in a can, you know, things of this sort. And it was designed to keep one man alive for 1 week. But the whole time I was a POW, the most they ever got was half a carton a week. So two men to a carton per week. So we were starving, you know, slowly starving. I only know my own experience. Everybody was turning into a skeleton. But I was always a tall, skinny kid. And when I was shot down, I weighed 165. And when I was liberated and the Americans weighed me, I weighed 125. So I'd gone through 40 pounds in just 6 months.
Makes you wonder how much longer you could have survived.
Yeah, it's this gnawing, and it's 24 hours a day. When you sleep, you dream about food. And they had a little game, a torturous game, naming some dish or a menu that we hadn't thought of before. You know, and somebody would say, I got another one, pineapple upside down cake. And I would say, oh.
Just dreaming of food.
Yeah,
huh?
Just dreaming of food. It was tough.
A lot of POWs from Europe have told me stories about the bread, or they've handed me the recipe for the bread.
Yeah,
the primary ingredient is sawdust.
Yeah, black bread with sawdust, yeah.
And you had to slice it somehow, even though it's hard as a rock.
I don't know how they ever got it so thin. It would be like an eighth of an inch. You know?
But you had to take what you could get.
Huh? That's all you got, yeah.
What do you think was the worst thing that you had to stomach, just because it was some kind of sustenance?
Probably the what we call the blood sausage. It was, like a thing about that round, and you got little cuts of the sausage, and it was foul meat, but at least it was some meat, some protein.
Did you ever fear that you would die there in the POW camp?
Not right in the camp, but as the Russians were advancing, and of course the Americans and the British were advancing, the rumors started to come that we were going to be evacuated and taken down into an Austrian redoubt, where the Germans were going to hide out to the end. The scuttlebutt was we were going to be the bargaining chip. They were going to hold us to the last minute and then bargain us out in terms of more favorable surrenders.
Right.
You know, and of course, we had been evacuated once from Saigon when the Russians got the
Well,
night.
Tell me about that. That must have been quite an interesting experience.
It was a snowstorm, you know. We had been following, you know, the Russians, and we knew they were getting closer and closer. And the night they put us on the road, the Rouse came through the barracks, you know, Rouse, 30 minutes, Rouse, we're leaving, 30 minutes. So you gathered up all whatever little, you know, things you had and prepared to march, and there was probably 6-8 inches snow on the ground. It was freezing, and it was snowing. And as we were being marched out of the camp, we could hear machine gun fire. Now, I don't know whether it was Germans firing, but the rumor passed through the group was that's the Russian advance patrols. They're that close that on the east side of Saigon, you could hear the machine gun fire. And, of course, we started marching west. And we went through, I think, 4 nights and 5 days marching. And it was that was the worst winter that they had had in 50 years in Germany.
Yeah.
And I read later, and I had heard some, you know, stories about it when we were doing this, how cold it was. But the average temperature, they were saying, for that march was 17 below zero. So it was freezing cold, you know.
And you've got no body mass to keep you warm.
Yeah,
you've
right.
lost 40 pounds.
Yeah, we're all skinny.
I'm sure you're weak. You're tired. Did you have anything to keep you warm at night?
Each carried, because when you went through Dulag, you know, there was another processing there where they would give you an army shirt and pants and a blanket and an overcoat, a scarf and a woolen hat, you know.
Uh-huh.
Just something, and a toothbrush. And a razor, I think, you know, a manual razor, something like that to get you started because, you know, you came down with nothing. And so you'd had to have that and whatever little things, you know, you got in the mail. And I never got anything in the mail because in 6 months I never got a letter from Casita at all. She got a couple from me, but they were so heavily deleted, you know, with black lines through it, you couldn't make sense of what I was saying. And I thought I was being very innocuous, you know, and saying
But they still censored it.
But they still censored it, yeah.
Yeah, but and, so she knew you were a prisoner?
Yeah. They got my mother and her got the notice Thanksgiving Day, and it was right around, give or take a day, around New Year's before they finally found that I was a POW.
So until then, the
first one you get is missing in action.
So they weren't sure you were alive until they got one that said you were POW.
Right. Yeah, from Thanksgiving to New Year's.
But you didn't know if she knew.
Yeah, no, you don't know. And, and the whole time I was prisoner, I never got a letter from anybody because they told me that it would take 6 months or better before you got your first letter. You know, I never got it.
So you're marching through the snow,
trying
to stay warm at night, waiting for a little more food. I'm sure your feet are freezing.
Oh, it was terrible. Yeah. Feet got wet And we were tired. You know, we had no stamina. You know, we couldn't do this. And in the back, everybody's mind was, don't go fast. Slow this down as far. We were hoping the Russians would overtake us.
Sure.
Know? So
you had better odds that way, huh?
And the POWs would stretch out for miles. It was, you know, thousands. Mm-hmm. You know, they stretch for miles.
Let me ask you a question just to put it in perspective. Because I, you know, you came out to greet me outside, and you struck me as a guy who's in really good shape for your age.
Everybody
and you're active.
Tells me that, yeah.
Yeah. Compare yourself at 92 to the strength that you had as a POW. Do you think you're stronger now than you were then at 22 because of your emaciated state?
Well, let's say I would have been stronger at 70 and maybe 80, but.
Yeah,
this last 10 years, I'm beginning to fade.
But that gives us some perspective. You were not a typical 22-year-old in terms of your physical ability at that point.
No, you're not, no.
Yeah,
no.
Worn down.
Yeah, you have no stamina.
So where did that march end?
We marched to a town called Spremberg, and then we were put on a train. And believe it or not, the trains were World War I boxcars that used to say, and they still do on the side, 10 horses and 40 men.
40 and 8, I think, right?
40 and 8, okay,
40 men, 8 horses.
8 horses, yeah. And we were in those boxcars, and I think we'd be up around 100. We could not all sit down. Mm-hmm. So we had to take stages. You'd stand up, and some would sit down on the floor, and the rest would stand, and then we'd take turns at this thing. And we were in that for another 4 days, I think. It took about 8 days for this whole trek. And so, and then by that time, we're coming down with dysentery. And boy, you know, when you got 1,000 guys and most of them are run, it was terrible. The train would stop every once in a while. Everybody would run out and just pull your pants down. And, you know, it was really bad.
Desperate situation.
The one plus in terms of Allied effort was we had an old guard. They put a guard in each car, and this guy would sit by the door with his rifle, and he fell asleep with holding his rifle, see, and the muzzle was up, see, and we scraped all the dirt and so we could find, and we slid down his rifle. the first time that guy shoots a rifle, it's going to blow up in his face, you know. And
did he ever figure it out?
No, he never did.
Not that you know of, anyway.
But you know, you do what you can. That's about all we could do that time.
Yeah. Well, it really seems that way to me, that those little things, just even a small annoyance or whatever you can come up with, was something that kept you guys going, gave you something to look forward to.
You're always, you know, trying to see an opportunity. And there were a few guys that tried to escape from this march. You know, a lot of people have referred to it as the German Death March. And,
and I
never want to put it that bad, certainly. But there were a number of people we had heard that had been shot trying to run, you know, to escape.
Well, and there were some who had been marching before the Russians got to you because the Russians had got to them sooner.
Oh, yeah. There were parades of these people headed west, you know, from all of the camps that were out in the East End. Yeah.
So where did you finally end up?
That's when we ended up down at Moosburg, you know, which was about 30 miles northeast of Munich. That was an army-run camp, whereas the Stalag was the Luftwaffe took care of the one in Sagan. But this was run by the German army, and it was much worse.
How so? What made it worse?
There was a certain amount of camaraderie or anything of that sort, but fellow airmen, you know, there was that kind of relationship between the Luftwaffe and the Allied airmen.
Even though you were enemies, there was some kind of mutual respect.
There was a mutual respect, yeah. But when you got down in the hands of the army, they couldn't care less, you know.
Uh-huh.
You were these damn fly boys that were, you know, a pain in the neck. Food got worse. We got no Red Cross parcels when we were down, because that was toward the end, you know. Germany was starting to collapse, you know, and I'm not sure it was, you know, conscious on their part or whether they just couldn't do any better, but things started to unravel. It was getting bad. Guys were passing out. They'd stand up, you know, and try to walk and pass out. As the Russians advanced, more and more POWs were put into this camp. And I was reading somewhere where the camp was designed for 14,000, and I think they ended up with over 50,000 people. They had put tents up in the parade grounds, you know, where we had to go out to be counted every day.
Yeah.
They had now tents loaded with guys, and it was, you know, nowhere near as easy as it was at Sagan. Not that that was easy, but little incidents come to mind. The next compound, when we were then in Sagan, had British Gurkha troops, you know, the turbans, the fellows from India.
Yeah.
With the knives, they all had knives. And they were bloodthirsty people. And the story was that a guard was sent into German into their camp to do something. And I don't know how this happened, but he never came out. And we heard through the scuttlebutt, I guess, that they had killed him and cut him up in pieces.
Wow.
And flushed him down the toilet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's how bad things got.
I've heard of some other guards. In fact, the most infamous guard on that German death march was a guy named Big Stoop, who apparently had the same fate befall him at the end of that march. Tell me about your liberation. Did you know it was about to happen?
Yes, because, you know, we would get the news on these radios, and we knew that the Americans were getting close, And the day we were liberated in the morning, there was a big battle. We were right outside of Munich, right outside of Moosburg. We could see the town, the roofs, and there was a church steeple and a flagpole. You could see the German flag all the time. And there was just bang, bang, bang. It went on all morning. And so we knew that they were within, you know, a mile or so of us. And so we all waited and sweated. And we were in the toilet, which was a cement concrete building, and looking out the empty windows at this thing. And it had the German flag. And I guess around noontime, the shooting seemed to stop. And it was quiet for a while. And then the German flag came down. And we were all watching this. And an American flag... I can't even say it without. Yeah.
You're overcome with emotion right now, remembering that.
And it went up, and it was upside down first time. Came down, and then it went up, and you all cheered.
Wow. Yeah. I can't imagine what that felt like after everything you've been through from the time that you got out of that airplane until then. I mean, that just had to be the most glorious thing you ever saw.
Yeah, it was. I'm sorry.
I think everyone understands the emotions that must be going through your heart right now.
It was the 13th Armored Division from Patton's 3rd Army.
Uh-huh.
And Patton himself showed up about the second day after we were liberated. You know, mm-hmm. we were still in the camp. You know, the guards had left and the medical people had come in and they brought a donut machine in to try to give us donuts. And the poor thing gave up thousands of donuts and finally quit, you know. But no, we were there for a number of days. Wire cutters started to appear. We cut our wire, all kinds of holes in the fence. The gate was open. Trucks started to come in with some rations. And one of the most shocking days in my experience at that point was we went through the gate. We just wanted to see what the town looked like. And we walked into the town. A couple of Jeeps went by and stopped. And, you know, they asked us who we were, and we told them. We said, where are you going? And they said, we're going down to Dachau, which was a few miles down the road by Munich. And they said, do you want to come? There was about three of us, I think. So we said, yeah, let's see what the other side, the concentration camp, looked like.
And little did you know how grave a situation you were going to see. We'll hear what Ray witnessed at that infamous Nazi concentration camp when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up a second program with a terrific storyteller and simply a pretty amazing American, Ray Maloney. You'll find a few photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we left off, Ray had been liberated after 6 months as a prisoner of war and had the opportunity to visit the newly liberated concentration camp at Dachau.
Well, we went down there, and it was the worst sight I think I've ever seen. There were piles of skeletons and dead bodies, and the stench was awful. And it was just unbelievable. There was one spot where the barracks had been burned, and in one corner of it, the bodies, the people inside, had tried to climb out from underneath, and they had got stuck and burned, you know, in the corner of this building right underneath. But everywhere you look, there were these piles of just bodies, you know, skeletons. It was terrible. And my last remembrance of the view of that was when Eisenhower was brought, when the war ended, Eisenhower came into Germany to look at some of this stuff. And he saw, I've forgotten which camp he went to, a concentration camp, and he ordered, and it passed out through all the army. Wherever there was a concentration camp, the nearest town, they took all the residents and took them out and made them go through the concentration camp to see what their countrymen had been doing.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I saw some pictures of it later, you know, the people going through and putting handkerchiefs over their faces and crying, the women, and it was just horrible, just a nightmare.
I'm sure that put a lot of thoughts in your head just to see that, just to fathom that humanity could do that.
Yeah.
Can you explain or help us understand how that changed your understanding of the entire war and everything that you and everyone had been doing and why?
Well, you know, it made us realize that as bad as we had it, there were some people that had it a lot worse, you know. And they were, of course, the political prisoners and, you know, and the Jewish race that the Germans were trying to, you know, eliminate. It was just awful.
You know, so many people say, and it's become almost a cliche when we talk about World War II, well, we could have been speaking Japanese or German.
Yeah.
When you see something like that, there's another consequence, and I'm sure you're pretty thankful that the Allies won.
Oh, of course.
So you have the glory of your liberation and then the heavy burden of seeing something like Dachau. But I'm sure before long you were thinking, hey, I might get to go see my wife again. This might be pretty fun.
Of course, yeah. We were taken to a camp in France called Lucky Strike. We spent about 2.5 weeks there, and we were, you know, agitating, let's get out of here. You know, we want to go home. And the priority for going home was wounded first, and then POWs, and then guys that had done their tours. And Eisenhower came through the camp, and I didn't sit at the table with him. They had these long tables, and they were feeding us 5 times a day, small meals, but 5 times a day. And they were trying to put some meat on us because we all looked like skeletons, you know. And that's what the delay was being caused. Was the medics were saying, keep the meal, let's fatten them up before they go home. And but Eisenhower came through and stopped and had lunch with us. And he was, you know, talking to everybody. And we were saying, General, can we go home? Eisenhower said, well, we're trying to get you home in style. We don't want you to have a rough crossing. But he said, you know, an option we're considering, but we haven't done anything, was to double load you, you know, half sleep and half stay on deck, and then in reverse.
You get twice as many people since
the bunks
aren't
on. Twice
as many
on the ships, yeah.
Yeah.
And we said, we don't care, General. Take us home. And so we came home that way, double loaded. They started to move out, I think, the very next day after Eisenhower, you know, gave the word. Another one of my most emotional moments of my military career was we came into New York City, and we was, you know, as I said, the wounded came first, and then the POW. So we were very early in returning, and of course the country was still celebrating, you know, the fact that we had won. And as we're coming up the straits, you know, Staten Island and Brooklyn on one side, you know, the New York Harbor.
Well, you certainly did. That's your hometown. What a place
sure.
to come back
to. I know. But along on the Brooklyn side, there was a kind of grassy bank, and they had a sign in plants, you know, all very cleverly done. And here I go. I'm going to say, the sign said, welcome home. Well done. I can't even. Sorry.
What message could have meant more to you in that moment than that? No one's ever shared that anecdote with me, and I know everyone at home is feeling the emotion of that moment for you. So many veterans, especially POWs, who learned what it felt like to live in the absence of freedom, have shared that when they did sail in, if they came into New York, that's something you sail past before you get to the port had special significance too. When you saw Lady Liberty, what did that mean to you?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was heaven. You know, like coming alive again, you know. And then when we tried to dock, there were so many people, you know, the POWs on the side of the boat that was docking, because there was a lot of people, you know, waving handkerchiefs and everything. They kept announcing, please get away from the starboard side. Because the ship was actually listing. You know, and they couldn't dock it in the position that it was in. And, you know, we were saying, stuff it, you know.
Do you know what we've been through? We're getting off this ship.
Yeah, right.
So was your wife there to greet you? Did she know you were coming in?
I guess she knew, because I think I had written or we sent, you know, priority cards or something. And I met her at Grand Central Station. She came down by herself. And the most beautiful girl in the world at that point.
Did she recognize it? Because you'd lost a lot of weight.
Yeah, I lost. Well, I had gained some back.
Yeah.
And also, I had grown a little mustache. This was something to do. You know?
What did that feel like in that moment? Because I'm sure there were days that you weren't sure you were going to see her again.
Yeah, there were. Yeah, yeah. You want to ask her? No, it was a great homecoming, and then the family gathered, you know. But then I stayed in, as I told you. And,
yeah.
I went back on occupation to Germany, and I flew in the Berlin airlift. You remember when that started?
Yeah.
When the Russian, yeah. They were needed pilots desperately, and we made a joke about any pilot that had seen a twin-engine aircraft was sent up to Frankfurt.
I was going to say, you're a fighter pilot. What
I
are you
know.
Doing flying? What, you
I
fly
know.
C-47s up there or C-46?
No, I flew C-47s
yeah.
as a co-pilot. You know, they needed a co-pilot to pick up the gear and, you know, back up the throttles and, you know, a couple
yeah.
of things. So they gave us a couple hours and said, go.
I imagine that had to be pretty surreal for you. Here you had been a prisoner in the German held territory, and now basically these folks are prisoners of their own country in Germany, you're
and
dropping
we
stuff
feeding,
that helps
yeah.
them survive.
Yeah, we were feeding them. Yeah, we were bringing food in, yeah.
What a role reversal. Here you're dependent on the Red Cross and these folks to give you food, and now you're returning the favor.
Yeah, huh? Right. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
That had to be pretty satisfying for you.
I didn't feel any emotion about that. The Russians fighters, you remember they closed the zone and they just left a corridor that we were allowed to fly in to go
right.
into Berlin. And the Russian fighter aircraft were buzzing the airlifting, the transports. And one of the reasons for calling on us to go as co-pilots, they wanted us to be able to identify Russian aircraft or, you know, see what you could. And so several times, about three times, as a matter of fact, I was buzzed by a Russian fighter, you know, and so it was an LA-5 or a Yak-3 or something.
Yeah, and there's so many elements of your story that are fascinating. You finally get out of the service, you go to college on the GI Bill, you end up graduating from Yale, you worked more than three decades with helicopters for Sikorsky.
Yeah, Sikorsky aircraft, yeah.
You have been at the wheel of the Bounty. I mean, you became an expert on that.
I decided that when I retired, you know, I got to do something with my brain. And I was always interested in that story. And I thought, well, I'll write a book about Mutiny on the Bounty. Because I majored in English in creative writing at Yale. So I started doing the research on it. And I went to Australia and England and Tahiti, you know, and I'm gathering up all the stuff, taking a lot of pictures and photographs. And so I got really deep into it, and I was about ready to start writing. And as I say, I had worked for Sikorsky for 33 years, and I was in marketing. And when you're trying to sell, you know, $20 million helicopters, first of all, you got to know the helicopter. So
yeah.
And I also flew the helicopters in the backyard at Sikorsky,
uh-huh.
so I could talk helicopter language to guys with, you know,
sure.
with helicopters. So I did that. And when I was about ready to start writing, I had also found out that there's 2,500 books written on the story of Mutiny on the Bounty. You know? And I had a good friend who had written one up in Hartford. And he had told me, unless you can unearth some of the mysteries that still exist in the story, that the publishers are not interested. If you're just going to redo the whole story, forget it. They're not interested. But at the same time, since my marketing experience selling helicopters, you got to stand up in front of a bunch of people, a squadron or Pentagon people. And Pentagon was my second home for years.
Sure.
Stand up in front of a bunch of people and talk about this helicopter. So I was used to lecturing and talking.
Right.
So when I was getting ready to start writing, some of my friends said, we'd love to see some of the slides. So I said, all right. So I put them in a chronological order one day and tried them on, and they were just flabbergasted. They said, what are you doing wasting your time writing? Go on the lecture circuit.
Uh-huh.
So I started to lecture. I got to the point where I had an agent.
And
I
people maybe recognize your voice from the History Channel or A&E.
Well, that came after I had, you know, started to earn a reputation for an expert.
And when
I became the historian for the Bounty organization, Tall Ship Bounty, when it was being brought up by amateur crews, I called them up and said, I'll do lectures if you let me sail it. So I ended up steering it after I had gone up to Mast a few times, and so I was their historian. I think it was the A&E channel
yeah.
came to me. I was doing some lectures for the Fall River Museum. They have a maritime
where
museum.
Where that replica of the bounty is
now. Where the replica of the bounty is. And I was doing the lectures there. Somebody got a hold of me and said, A&E would like to talk to you. And so some gal came to the museum, and I met with her. And she asked me, would I help do this program? So they did a documentary on it. And I was the voice, you know, the speaking head, the talking head for that one. And also, and I credits for the technical consultant was me. Then I got a call later on from somebody from History Channel and wanted to do the same thing. So I did it for the History Channel. When I was doing a lecture in Connecticut, New Canaan, one point, to a men's club, a guy in the audience who I didn't know had booked a cruise for he and his wife to Tahiti. He heard my lecture, and without my knowledge, he talked to a friend of his in the Cunard Line in the New York office, that was headquarters for Cunard Line in America. And he said, if you're interested in having a guy talk about Mutiny on the Bounty, because Tahiti is, you know, where this thing started, he said, there's a guy in Connecticut you ought to get a hold of for lecturing.
Yeah.
So a few weeks later, I get a call from an agent who books the entertainment and, you know, the enrichment programs for the cruise ship. And she went through this thing about would I like to, you know, do it on a cruise? And I said, yes, sir, I'd be. And I ended up with about five or six cruises. It got to the point where Cressida wouldn't go anymore. You know, so, but we did cruises to the Pacific. And I was doing lectures on the ships.
How about that? Maybe there's some folks listening right now who heard one of your lectures.
I don't know.
I know we're short on time here, but I want to know, you recently got to go on an honor flight from Florida to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial. What did you get out of that? What did it mean to you?
Oh, it was an emotional high, a day I'll never forget. I'm going to choke up again. It was so, all day long, everywhere we went to every war memorial in Washington, and of course the big one is World War II. Have you seen it in Washington?
Yeah.
So you know what it is. But everywhere, people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. And you know, I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high all day long. On the flight back, they called mail call. Have you gotten that one? And all of my grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and also some second and third grade children, had written letters to me. How does it feel to be a hero? And, you know, this guy from these children, it was just such an emotional high. And the crowning touch was when we got back at 10:30 at night to Fort Myers Airport. They lined us up all on one of the long corridors, you know, where the gates are. Make sure they got all 50 of us in wheelchairs. Half of us didn't need the wheelchair, you know.
I know you don't.
They wanted us all in wheelchairs, and they wheeled us through the terminal. And according to the newspaper, there was over 1,000 people to greet us at 11 o'clock at night.
Wow.
You know, they had a bagpipe band going and state troopers lined up and everybody saluting and the kids with flags, you know, and signs. And it just tears you up. There's no other way to describe it. You can't cope with it.
Well, the thing that comes to mind for me as we wrap this up, and I want to add to all those people and say thank you for serving our country and for telling us your story in such an incredible way. I mean, it really has been powerful for us to hear this.
Paul,
I go back to you being a POW and what you shared with us about how that made you feel, that you weren't doing anything, that you couldn't help.
You know, they've struck a medal for POWs now.
Yeah.
I've never applied for it.
You never wanted it. But now you go on this honor flight and all these people thinking you've got a crowd waiting for you. Hmm. Did it change your mind about that or change that feeling of whatever you dealt with 70 years ago?
Well, I always thought that they were thanking me for what I did in combat, my little contribution to winning the war. That's what I felt like they were thanking me for, not the part of being a POW. That didn't take any skill or anything at all, you know.
So you still experience some of those feelings?
Yeah, I have a guilty feeling all the time. I'm not proud of it.
Well, you have a lot of other things that you can be proud of, including that beautiful wife of yours and this growing family.
Well, thank you. And
again, thanks so much for telling us your story. Is there anything we left out that you think we need to know?
Oh, God, I don't know.
What do you look forward to now? Because you seem like you've got a lot of energy. What keeps you going so strong?
You know, these airplanes with remote control airplanes. I'm not into that, but since I'm a sailor, I have a little remote control sailboat out in the garage.
Yeah.
And right out in this lake here, I don't know if you've noticed, there's a few little racing marks, and there's about 8 or 10 of us around. Monday afternoon, 2 o'clock, we race these little sailboats around. So that's the only sport, really, that I, you know, I'm so old, I can't do any sports anymore. I owned a sailboat for most of the time I worked at Sikorsky and lived in Connecticut.
Sure.
And so we did a lot of cruising up, you know, Boston. And I helped a guy take a powerboat, 39-foot cruiser, from Connecticut down to Fort Myers. We did that. That was a 19-day cruise, and that was fun, you know.
Yeah.
Just three men, three good friends.
One last question I need to ask you. As someone who aspires to be married as long as you have, 70 years of marriage, don't tell me the secret's being a POW for 6 months of that, because I don't want to try that. But what do you think the secret is for you and Cressida to be so united and happy with each other 70 years later?
You know, we talk about it and make jokes about it. Obviously, you know, we loved each other. I was really her first boyfriend. And she always says that the reason she married me was because of my sense of humor. I make her laugh. And I've always, I guess, earned the reputation for having a good sense of humor. Other than, you know, I have a short temper. I'm an Irishman, you know, with a short temper. But she puts up with it, and we get by. And we think that in addition to being, you know, husband and wife, we're good friends. That kind of bridges any of the problems we have.
I like it.
We're good friends.
Well, that's a good example for the rest of us to follow. Ray Maloney, 92 years old. If you missed the first part of his interview, you'll find both episodes with Ray at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time for now. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.